and there is a need to sort out their problem. And this is where I think the problem will come very soon, because there is the willingness of the two leaders to sort out problem. But is the Senegalese economy, is the Senegalese education system, is the Senegalese social system able to allow him to find job, to allow him to sort out some of these economic problems? I really doubt it. I really doubt it, because the state that they inherited is the state completely down, completely down. And they have only 5 years. And I doubt that in 5 years, you can really change, you can really make a shift in the Senegalese economic political system. But I do hope that they will start taking specific action that will show to the population that at least this generation of leaders are more inclined to help the population than to help themselves. I think that's where the line is.
And finally, former Prime Minister Amanata Touré, they run as Pan-Africanists. The significance of what they're talking about when it comes, as Ibrahima was talking about, education, where women stand in this government in this final minute that we have.
Well, first of all, I like to say that I'm a little bit optimistic that, you know, my...
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO has just finished our annual All Frills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of our programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's board of directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. At a rate of 1,000 new cases a week, today Multnomah County leaders heard about the impact of serious child abuse cases. The governor signs new legislation about insulin. And former Congresswoman Liz Cheney lays out the case against Trump to an Oregon audience. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. It's a crime against the most vulnerable out there, children. And too often it's ignored. But today, Multnomah County Commissioners decided to pass a resolution calling this Child Abuse Awareness Month. They heard from several people with direct knowledge of how child abuse affects the community, including those who take the perpetrators to court. First, they heard from Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt.
Unfortunately, we see child abuse and neglect too often in our community. As prosecutors, we have an important duty and an obligation to respond to child abuse cases that are referred to our office. Our child abuse multidisciplinary team, led by Senior Deputy District Attorney Chuck Mickley, has the responsibility of prosecuting nearly all criminal cases involving child victims in Multnomah County. This includes child homicides, felony sex crimes against children, felony child physical abuse cases, and felony child abandonment cases. This team is made up of our very most dedicated prosecutors in our office. They continue to work in some of the most horrific cases our office sees because they believe in protecting our children, ensuring justice for victims and their families, and holding people accountable who commit these despicable acts. Our office also works closely with CARES Northwest, a community-based medical program that works to assess, treat, and prevent child abuse. That prevention piece is critically important. And while we work to hold accountable those perpetrating these acts, we must also work together to find ways to prevent child abuse from happening. I also want to recognize the members of the Multnomah County Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Team who are here with us today. The team includes representatives from CARES Northwest, local law enforcement, public schools, hospitals, health departments, local mental health service providers, the Oregon Department of Human Services, and Multnomah County's Department of Community Justice. The team works with community partners to protect children who have been abused and neglected while ensuring that all practices are trauma-informed and mitigate the lifelong consequences of child abuse. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my senior deputy district attorney, Chuck Mickley.
Over the last 11 and a half years, I've exclusively been dedicated to prosecution of child abuse cases here in Multnomah County. I have seen an amazing range of emotions, from the carnage that child abuse visits upon children to the resilience that children demonstrate and the care and attention that they receive from the people who are supporting them in law enforcement, at DHS, at CARES Northwest, to help them heal and to help them recover from really some very horrible things. And I've seen everything from a parent who loses their cool and over-disciplines a child, everything from that to a child homicide. I'm only seeing these cases on the back end once DHS, once law enforcement, once CARES, most of the time has had an opportunity to meet with the children and to try to help them out. In the state of Oregon, in January of 2024, there were over 13,000 reports made to the child abuse hotline statewide. I want to talk just briefly about the work that CARES Northwest does. I want to convey my special thanks to the work that they've done over the past several years, not only providing a place where children can talk about the horrible things that have happened to them, but also to provide aftercare and therapy and counseling to children. Law enforcement goes out and deals with the most gruesome of things, and talks to the children, talks to the offenders, and does excellent work in trying to hold offenders accountable. One of the things that I'm happiest with about law enforcement and some of their recent focus has been on the prevention side, working on internet crimes against children so that we can find offenders.
Those were some of the people speaking about child abuse and how it impacts the community at the Multnomah County Commission meeting today. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek will seek ethics guidance on expanding the role of the Office of the First Spouse. According to an announcement today, Kotek has faced some scrutiny after she made public plans to expand the role of her wife, Amy Kotek Wilson. They're working on a six-month pilot program, but before it kicked off, three of Kotek's closest advisors either quit or went on leave. Other states have a first spouse office where the spouse of the governor takes on projects, though many of the roles are ceremonial. Amy Kotek Wilson has worked in mental and behavioral health, has a master's degree in social work, and a personal history with addiction. At a press conference, Kotek explained why she is seeking guidance from the Ethics Commission. She said, quote, "We weren't sure what questions we needed to ask. We are now expediting that because of the public interest. Just to be clear, she is an unpaid volunteer with both lived and professional experience on an issue that is important to Oregonians. How do you do that within ethical norms guidance? That's why we're seeking that from the Ethics Commission," end of quote. The governor declined to answer why her staffers left. Kotek says the questions for the Ethics Commission will be submitted by Friday. Portland Street Response may have more support from the mayor's office than previously thought. The non-emergency response team was founded back in 2021 to help people experiencing mental and behavioral health crises. The Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, or PCEP, hosted a town hall meeting recently regarding future plans for Portland Street Response. Community members showed up both in person and over Zoom to give public input. The main goal for the Portlanders was to secure funding for the response team. Stephanie Howard is Portland's Director of Community Safety. Howard told the crowd, quote,
I really want people to take away from this that there is an absolute sincere commitment to stabilizing this program, to making it successful, and to try to make sure that it is positioned in the best way to serve the community," end of quote. Attendees discussed other important issues, from extending hours of operation to whether or not Portland Street Response workers can enter residences to respond to calls. Former City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty said city leaders aren't tapping available Medicaid funding for Portland Street Response that would allow the program to operate 24/7. Hardesty said, quote, "The city could have, over a year ago, made Portland Street Response eligible for federal Medicaid funding, and because of poor leadership, that 80% reimbursement rate that the federal government that Ron Wyden and I worked together on to get is just sitting there languishing," end of quote. PSEP will finalize their recommendations after their next meeting on April 17th. Mayor Ted Wheeler will have 60 days to respond. The Oregon legislature has ensured that insulin prices are capped at $35 a month starting in 2025. This action will help people with diabetes, which is the eighth leading cause of death in the country. KBOO reporter Birdie has the details.
Oregon lawmakers during the 2024 session took another step to further limit the price of insulin. Governor Tina Kotek has signed a new bill into law that will cap out-of-pocket insulin prices at $35 per month. Andrea Meyer with AARP Oregon says in 2019, the legislature capped prices at $75 per month, but allowed for cost of living increases. She says the current cost cap is about $85 with this increase.
This past legislative session, the Oregon legislature updated that law, and now most Oregon residents with diabetes will see lower out-of-pocket costs for insulin next year. It is set at $35 a month, and there will be no cost of living increase.
Meyer says this new price is now set in stone. It goes into effect on January 1st, 2025. Diabetes affects nearly 12% of Americans. That's about 38 million people nationwide. It's also the eighth leading cause of death. Meyer says access to insulin impacts how people treat the disease.
For far too many Oregonians, high prices of insulin have forced them to ration their insulin or even go without, which can lead to deadly consequences. So reducing this drug to no more than $35 a month will make this life-saving drug more affordable and accessible to most Oregonians.
26 states and Washington, D.C. have capped insulin prices. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Birdie.
Oregon pharmacy shelves now stock a birth control pill that you don't need a prescription for. O-Pill is the first over-the-counter birth control pill to hit the shelves after the FDA approved it last year. It's a progestin-only pill, and it comes with fewer risks than the common combination birth control pills that have progestin and estrogen. O-Pill and others like it is safe to be taken by folks who might otherwise have to avoid a combination pill, like nursing mothers and people with high blood pressure or vascular disease. CVS, Walgreens, and Rite Aid are all stocking the product for about $20 for a 28-day supply. Since 2016, pharmacists in Oregon have been able to prescribe birth control pills, which was helpful since wait times to see a primary doctor can be long. Now health experts say it will be even easier for people to get birth control and reduce unintended pregnancies. That's especially true for folks who may have let their previous prescription lapse and now have to wait to see a doctor. The FDA recommends that people take the pill at the same time every day to get the maximum effectiveness. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mill Gertoff. Then it's KBOO News In Depth, where we'll be speaking with journalist Josephine Woolington about her article, Underground Seed Banks Hold Promise for Ecological Restoration. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, it'll be cloudy with a low of 40. Tomorrow, those clouds continue, a high of 56. Today in history, in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. delivers his Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence speech in New York City. 1 year later, on this day, he was assassinated by James Earl Ray in Memphis, Tennessee. Our quote of the day is from Hispano-Roman scholar Isidore of Seville, who died on this day in 636. He said, quote, "Without music, there can be no perfect knowledge. for there is nothing without it. For even the universe itself is said to have been put together with a certain harmony of sounds, and the very heavens revolve under the guidance of harmony. Former Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney led the inquiry into January 6th and paid a price for calling out her own party's president. Cheney visited Portland to kick off the Oregon Historical Society's Hatfield Lecture Series in March. Here's part of her commentary at the Arlene Schnitzer Auditorium.
When I look back on that period of time after the 2020 election up through January 6th, the best sort of analogy that I have is it felt like I was in an airplane looking down through the clouds, and I would get momentary glimpses of what Donald Trump and his allies were trying to do, but I didn't understand the full picture as it unfolded. And right after the election, I think many Republicans, I know many Republicans in Congress thought, all right, look, the election's over. I went to see Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader then. This was 2 days after the election. He told me he'd talked to Trump and that Trump knew he'd lost. And then Kevin said we needed to let Trump go through all the stages of grief, which became clear pretty quickly that for Trump, at least one of the stages of grief was tweeting in all caps a lot. We all thought he may litigate, he has the right to do that, but the election will be called, he'll concede, and we can move on. And of course, that's not what happened. And I became very concerned about the third week of November as the claims that were being made got more crazier and crazier, that I sent out a statement saying, if you have evidence to back these claims up, you have to produce the evidence. But if you don't, you have to respect the results. You have to respect the outcome. We went through a whole period of time where it became clear he wasn't going to respect the outcome of the election. As we got to the day of January 6th, it was clear that there was going to be the potential for violence. There were members of Congress, even the day before, Republican members of Congress in our meetings, who were expressing concern. One member, Debbie Lesko from Arizona, who was very pro-Trump, she actually stood up in our House Republican meeting and she said, wait a minute, we've told all of these people to come to Washington and they might be able to change the outcome of the election, and they're going to be angry when they realize they can't. And it was a moment of clarity where she was saying out loud, it was the truth. That is what these people had been told. Of course, I didn't know that Donald Trump was going to stand on the ellipse and, knowing that the crowd was angry and was armed, that he was going to order them basically to march on the Capitol. And as the events of that day unfolded, I think the emotion I remember the most was real anger. I was on the floor of the House in the chamber as the mob attacked. And at one point, Jim Jordan came over to me. Now, I'll just back this up by saying my first encounter with Jim Jordan when I was elected to Congress was the following. So Jim came and sat down next to me at a House Republican meeting. This was probably in early 2018. And he said to me, do you want to join the Freedom Caucus? And I looked at him, and this was his pitch, I kid you not. He said, we don't have any women and we need one. Tempting as that was, I said no. But Jim, more than any other member of Congress, I believe, was directly involved with Donald Trump in the planning for the effort to steal the election. And so as the mob was attacking the Capitol and we'd been told to remove gas masks from under our chairs and they'd locked the doors to the chamber and you could hear the mob banging, I was standing in the aisle of the chamber of the House, and Jim Jordan walked over to me and he said to me, we need to get the ladies off the aisle. And then he put his arm out and he said, let me help you. And I pushed his arm away and I said to him, and I won't repeat exactly what I said, but it was, I feel confident that Gert Boyle would have approved. But the idea that this mob that he had been part of inspiring at a minimum was attacking and he was suggesting I needed his help was one of many moments of anger that day. But after the attack was finished and the Capitol had been cleared, we went back into the House chamber and it was about 8:30 or 9 o'clock that night. And I wanted to walk through the rotunda and through Statuary Hall and see the damage. And I wasn't prepared for what I saw. which was in the rotunda and in Statuary Hall, all around the walls, the statues in Statuary Hall and in the rotunda, were members of law enforcement who were resting against the statues, resting against the walls, exhausted. And I was going around thanking them for what they'd done. And one of them said to me, I fought in Iraq, and I have never experienced what I experienced today in terms of just the medieval, bloody, hand-to-hand combat of battling that mob that was trying to invade the Capitol. And we should never forget that. And one more point that we must never forget is that attack, while it was happening, Donald Trump was watching it on television. He was sitting in his dining room next to the Oval Office, watching the assault on the Capitol, watching those police officers be brutally assaulted and attacked. And people were pleading with him to tell the mob to stop. And for over 3 hours, he wouldn't do it.
And that was former Congresswoman Liz Cheney speaking to a Portland audience last month. Election administrators around the country have been fighting misinformation about election integrity. Now, a new poll shows that while deep political divisions remain, 81% of Americans say they have friends with different political beliefs than their own. And as Mike Moen reports, it also suggests the potential for political violence may be something to watch.
In a new PBS Marist poll, 1 in 5 U.S. adults believes Americans may have to resort to violence to resolve political divisions. The level of acceptance was higher among Republicans. These results follow lingering false claims about the outcome of the 2020 presidential race. Ward County Auditor Marissa Hammond doesn't express great worry about attacks or threats happening in her jurisdiction, but in the current climate, safety is a priority.
Making sure things are secure, election workers are prepared on what to do if something is to happen.
She adds there's coordination between her office, first responders, and local law enforcement agencies closer to an election. With the 2024 race for the White House taking shape, the 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, led by supporters of former President Donald Trump, remains a talking point as he tries to reclaim the presidency. And just like election misinformation, Hammond encourages voters feeling a sense of outrage about the political landscape to seek out reliable information, suggesting it could give them a more measured outlook. And for those with more of an open mind, signing up to be a poll worker is something to consider.
Volunteer for election work, and that's probably the best way to see how things are handled and understand the process.
For voters worried about heightened political tensions, Hammond encourages them to take advantage of options such as mail-in voting. This is Mike Moen.
Nebraska aims to change how it awards electoral college votes. Nearly 50,000 Wisconsin Democrats vote uncommitted to protest Biden's handling of Gaza. And voters there approve of a ban on private donations for election administration. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
When you look at the map, that one electoral vote really matters in the combination of other things. Then you need another state.
Former Obama campaign manager Jim Messina says President Joe Biden could lose an important electoral college vote if Nebraska changes to a winner-take-all system. The Republican governor is asking the legislature to do that, saying it would let the deep red state speak with one unified voice. Nebraska and Maine are the only two states that still split their electoral college votes by congressional district. Low turnout primaries Tuesday in Connecticut, New York, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin showed vulnerabilities for both Biden and former President Donald Trump. The Republican only got around 80% in the races, even though he has no serious opposition. And college student Dahlia Saba is one of the nearly 50,000 Wisconsin Democrats voting uncommitted to protest Biden's handling of Gaza.
It is a way for us to quantify, this is how many people care about this issue. We are Democrats. We are voting in the Democratic primary. These are your constituents, and your policy is alienating them.
Wisconsin voters also amended the state constitution to ban private donations for running elections, similar to moves in half of the states. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Brian Stile says, without proof, that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg used large donations specifically to mobilize Democrats in 2020 battlegrounds.
Elections are partisan, but elections administration should never be partisan.
Zuckerberg did donate hundreds of millions for poll worker training and safety supplies to help local governments run elections during the pandemic. There is no evidence it was a partisan effort. Senator Bernie Sanders and President Biden came together Wednesday to tout the progress made to cut the cost of inhalers and to press Congress to do more to lower the cost of prescriptions. Sanders says Americans still pay the world's highest drug prices.
1 out of 4 Americans cannot afford to purchase the prescriptions that their doctors write, and some of them will die as a result.
Abortion rights measures could be on the ballot in 11 states this fall, including Arizona. Pro-choice advocates there say they've gotten more than enough signatures to let voters decide if access should be a fundamental right protected by the state's constitution. Chris Love with Arizona for Abortion Access calls it a bipartisan issue.
The vast majority of Arizona voters from across the political spectrum trust that we should be free to make our own personal medical decisions without government interference.
Meanwhile, Democrats say Florida could be in play this election thanks to referendums on abortion and recreational marijuana. The state Supreme Court approved both earlier this week. I'm Catherine Carley.
The Native community lends support in the search for a missing student, and South Dakota researchers work to understand the Native maternal health care divide. For these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Members of the Native community in Lawrence, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri are supporting Haskell Indian Nation's university students and the family and friends of missing Haskell student Cole Brings Plenty. Brings Plenty, who's also an actor, is known for his role in the TV show 1923, was last seen in Lawrence on Sunday. This week, members of the Native community have held gatherings at Haskell, which is located in Lawrence, to hold space and offer prayers as police search for Brings Plenty and are seeking his arrest in connection to an alleged domestic violence incident at an apartment in Lawrence on Sunday. The Kansas City Indian Center is offering its support as staff attends the gatherings and shares information, including missing person flyers of Brings Plenty. In a telephone interview Wednesday with Kansas City Indian Center Executive Director Gaylene Krauser, she said the Native community is coming together because when a Native person goes missing, they often do not get much public attention or media attention to help find them. Krauser says she's been in brief contact with his family, which has expressed it's out of character for Brings Plenty to be out of touch with his family and friends. As for the accusations against Brings Plenty, his family has posted on social media that the most important thing right now is to locate him and that there's a time and place to address the allegations. Krauser agrees with the family's sentiments and says the Indian Center will continue to offer its support in the search. As of Wednesday afternoon, the Lawrence, Kansas Police Department had no new information or updates on the search for Brings Plenty. According to the police department regarding the incident, officers responded to reports of a female screaming for help, but the suspect fled before officers arrived. Police say the investigation has identified Brings Plenty as the suspect and that traffic cameras showed his vehicle leaving the city, traveling southbound on 59 Highway. Brings Plenty was last known to be driving a 2005 white Ford Explorer. Anyone with information is asked to call police. Meanwhile, students at Haskell have built a fire and will keep it burning until Brings Plenty is found. Students are also meeting to plan a search party. Researchers are working to understand all factors underlying maternal health care for Native Americans in western South Dakota. Most counties west of the Missouri River are considered a maternal health care desert. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports, that means women live more than 100 miles away from medical providers that specialize in delivery.
Distance, weather, transportation, and trauma are just a few of the barriers standing in the way of pregnant Native American women needing or wanting prenatal health care. That's coupled with a lack of providers West River, both in reservations and in the Black Hills. Dr. Amy Elliott is a chief research officer at Avera McKinnon. She describes the issue bluntly.
It's crisis levels with the lack of obstetrics providers, especially on the western side of the state. How do we find solutions, not just for recruiting more people, but also do we have to think a little bit different about how we deliver care?
According to the South Dakota Department of Health, from 2012 to 2021, American Indians made up 20% of all live births, but 44% of all pregnancy-associated deaths. Elliott and others want to fully understand what's causing that issue and others. Elliott says a lack of data hinders insight into understanding causes or generating solutions.
An advantage of being within a health system is we have access to quite a bit of data, and we also have close partnerships with the Department of Health, with Great Plains Tribal Leaders Board, and so we're able to help maybe combine some different data streams that haven't been combined before.
For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It's time for our brain teaser this Thursday. For that, we go to Pearl Star from KPOV Vend with a point puzzle, a weekly radio puzzle challenging listeners with word and logic puzzles.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to take something associated with Easter in two words. Drop three letters, and you are left with a company that might help you in a nor'easter. Well, the answer is jelly bean. Drop the J-E-Y, and you have L-L bean. Our winner this week is Harold, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
Mr. Rabbit, your ears are mighty long. Yes, don't you know they were put on wrong? Every little soul's gonna shine, shine. Every little soul's gonna shine along.
For the new puzzle, send me three words for baby animals. If you change an L to a T, you will have exactly two of each letter used. So again, I'm looking for three words for baby animals. Combine all the letters and change an L to a T, and you will have exactly two of each letter. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Yes, sir.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of April 1st. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Matea Carlin, and Bertie. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billing.